Welcome to episode 2 of the Adoption and Fostering podcast. How's your lockdown, hun? Happy St. Patrick's Day to everybody. I'm only saying that because I'm in Ireland and obviously the pubs are shut, so I'm stuck here talking to Daniel tonight. That sounds wrong. Sorry, Daniel.
Second choice, you know.
Yeah. Well, like I say, the pubs are closed, literally, so, you know. So this is the second in the series of, second in episode in the series of 4 episodes talking to adopted adults, adult adoptees, care experienced adults, and basically we're chatting to them about how the lockdown's been. So last week we talked to Polly, and I'd like to put it out there, apologies for the audio last week. We have found the issue, which was basically I was using my headphones as a microphone. So Al Coates has kindly come along earlier this evening and sorted me out, told me off, and he's going to report me to HR. So there we go. So that's all good. And Daniel, you witnessed all of that. You can confirm
I did.
That I got told off.
You absolutely did.
So Daniel, thank you for joining me. Really appreciate
pleasure. Thank
it.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So introduce yourself, first of all, and tell us a bit about yourself.
So I'm Daniel. I'm a late discovery adoptee. I found out I was an adoptee a bit later in life than I believe is generally the case. I'm married. I'm a father of 2 little boys who are 5 and 2, and just moved out to sort of leafy North Essex. We've been in the new house for 2 weeks. So we've been busy.
Yeah, sounds it. I've gotten so many questions about moving house during the pandemic and like buying, selling, all that sort of stuff, but we won't go there because that's not what we're here to talk about. So when I first contacted you about doing this, you were just in the process of moving, weren't you? So we were a little bit.
Yeah, no, it was handy in a way, especially with schools going back. It
yes, meant, of course.
We moved just before we went back to school. Yeah, that's quite handy, really.
Yeah. So you threw me a curveball earlier because you, I mean, in my head, anybody who is your age, if I can say that, not too far off me, but you know, you're good, nearly 10 years away from me, younger that is. Assumptions are that people know about their adoptive status, if that's the way towards it. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know. From other sort of adoptees I've spoken to, which isn't a huge amount, or people who work in the sector, it's my story is somewhat unusual. I found out at 26, and the way I found out was that I was at home and then I had to move back into my adopted parents' house. Right. One night, my adopted dad, who at the time I believed was my dad, he died suddenly.
Oh, okay.
And a couple of days after that, I took on the job of collecting all the documents that you have to do when you register a death. And then in the documents file, where all the birth certificates things are, I'd find my adoption certificate in there. And that's how I found out.
Wow. I mean, there's so many questions I can ask you about that. And there's a whole conversation around it. And I know you've spoken to Claire, How to Be Adopted. You're doing her podcast, aren't you? And you've written a blog for her. So rather than take away from that and being, I really respect Claire and the work that she's trying to do as well. So I think we won't go too deep into it, but if it comes up, then, you know,
it's a big thing and it's bound to.
Yeah, and I was going to say as well, with what's going on in the world at the minute as well, it may have impacted what you're about to tell us as well in terms of how you've dealt with stuff and what have you.
I'm sure there is. There's probably a lot more to it than what I probably realise, and I don't think you 100% realise how things and circumstances have affected you until you do conversations like this, because you might see it in a different way to what I do or someone else has, and it might spark off a different thought or whatever. Yeah. So it's why I like doing these sorts of things. I think it's important, you know, about the big thing about owning your own narrative and your own story And until the age of 26, I didn't even start owning my own story.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, thank you all. The microphone is sorted. I can't swear because we're live on Facebook. And I guess if I can ask you, in terms of relationships and stuff, because you're married, you've got two kids.
Yeah.
Which, fabulous. And they sound like a great age as well.
They're lots of fun.
Do you think... I guess this might be hard for you to answer. I don't know. Do you think that it's made a difference to how you are as a dad, having your own kids? You know,
yeah.
Is it different to you expected, etc.? You know, in terms of having something biological.
Yeah, hugely. I mean, the first thing is my oldest son is 5, and he is the first biological relative of mine that I've met.
Yeah.
So that's an odd thing to say when you're talking about your toddler son.
Yeah.
But going through sort of a pregnancy or two that I've done now with your wife, and you see the scans and physically you see the baby growing.
Yeah.
And understanding that bond that must exist between a child and its mum. Physically it's there, isn't it? And then you go through the labour and the birth, and then you physically break that because the cord's cut, and then you start repairing that straight away with the sort of the skin on skin, and you're trying to repair that initial trauma of birth.
Yeah.
And then you as a dad are trying to get in on that as well, because it's, you've both got a bond. It's a, you know, it's a joint thing. I believe in parenting is a, you know, it's a joint effort.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't help but sort of empathise with my birth mum, because we had 5 days before we were separated. So there was time there that we had together. And, you know, when we were home on day 5, that sort of hit me a little bit. I turned around and said to my wife, I said, day 5.
Yeah.
We were separated on this day, and it was like a sort of a bit of a big thing, and it's given me an example of the sort of honesty thing, that I'm always honest with my children, as age appropriate as you can be, and you don't, like, they're at the age where they're asking questions, because I know Nanny and Grandad, and Nanny and Grandad on the other side as well. That's my birth mum. And but they ask sort of questions, because they see photos of my wife when she was a child with Nanny and Grandad, and they don't see that from my side, and they sort of ask, you know, who was your dad when you was a kid? My oldest one's asked, and I don't lie to him. No. I just tell him what my truth is, and same as what about, you know, you and Nanny? And I'll say, well, we weren't allowed to live together like, you know, mummy and other nanny were. And he sort of takes it in and thinks about it, then he goes off, and I'm sure when he's older there'll be more.
Yeah.
But it's I think about how I'm parenting all the time because of that. It's like almost every situation you're dealing with, behaviour or even not just that bit, but all the way through my childhood, I think I've got an example of how not to parent. So I think about what happened to me in my old house when I was a kid, because the house I just moved from was my childhood house.
The house
It's a bit of odd. It held a lot of memories for me, some all right, a lot of them horrendous.
Right.
And And it's sort of nice in a way that both my kids have had my first bedroom. We've all had the same first bedroom and sort of that sort of thing. Yeah. But it's like everywhere I turned in that house, there was like, this happened in this room and this happened there. And I remember when I was that age at the bottom of the stairs when that happened, and all this sort of was going around all the time. So every time my kids are misbehaving or asking a question, I was thinking back to it all the time. Yeah. It's like, you know, even I remember when I asked questions of my parents when I was a kid, when you first started doing sort of biology at school,
Yeah.
You ask them questions, and then I know now that they haven't, it's not just they hadn't told me the truth, they told me lies.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. That's quite, yeah, that's quite hard hitting, actually, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it does sometimes. Yeah. Really hard. Yeah. But a lot of the time, it's just I'll sit here like now and talk to you really matter-of-factly about it.
Yeah.
And it just is. That's just my life, and that's how it is.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, for what it's worth, I'm glad that it's moved on from days like that. And I know that's not of any benefit to you, but, you know, I just hate to think that you would keep such a big secret. And I know that was a done thing many years ago, but, you know, times have moved on.
Yeah, that's it. And I think it's sort of shame, isn't it? Shame's a very powerful driver in terms of people's emotions and their actions.
Yeah.
And you see it. I mean, my adopted mum was Irish. She was born in the 40s. So she grew up in... So if you've seen Philomena, that is the island that she's grown up in. And like driven by that sort of Catholic sort of shame, and it sort of drove everything, the house, especially when it comes to children and unwed. Yeah. You know, and you can tell that's the way that's how they were brought up, you know, educated by nuns in a nun school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all that. It's like, it almost like ticks every box of shame being a driver. Yeah. But, you know, what I know about them now is they had their own unaddressed traumas that they were dealing with as adults, and almost they were trying to use me to fix that. And I couldn't fix that. They weren't able to have biological children on their own after I had an older brother, but he was 20 when I was born.
My
adopted parents. So I was in a house with three adults.
Yeah.
One of whom was a sibling, but he was 20.
Right.
20 years older than me. And it's a weird setup anyway, and it always felt weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's an odd dynamic in anyone's house. You have a sibling, you're of a similar age normally.
Yeah. Or there's a couple of years, or
Yeah, you know, my kid 2 and 5, it's sort of normal, but
it's 20. Kind of the average normal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's odd.
20 years is a long time.
It's odd and it felt odd. And I know why now.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is really an interesting perspective, and one that I've personally not heard before in the conversations that we've done or some of the interviews that we've done in the podcast. So thanks for sharing that. I was just thinking there, because I didn't know about the Irish connection, I hope that my happy St. Patrick's Day green at the beginning didn't trigger you too much, because obviously I live here and I'm like, I know that that kind of stuff used to happen here, and to a certain extent, there's still a lot of change happening, and we've obviously got massive thing with mother and baby things over here at the minute. So there's been lots of issues, but there's been lots of change as well. And, you know, I know from living here now, you know, when I say my three sons are adopted, it's like I've kind of, you know, like it's completely wrong, because people see adoption now as very much how it was over here. I mean, you know, the nuns and the mother and baby units and all that sort of stuff. It's a very shamed kind of experience, but thankfully we can, you know, we can teach and we can kind of share. And my kids can as well. They're old enough to be able to kind of put people right and what have you.
Yeah, that's a great thing. I can see that sort of change and the other sort of things I've been pulled into, because I've got no really experience of the care sort of sector. As in, I can't remember the social work visits to my house. I know that they happened because I've seen the records, but I don't remember them because I was too young. So when, like, I'm in sort of these sort of groups that I sit on and hear other adoptees talk about their experiences of social workers and things like this, I don't know, but I can tell by the way they're talking that it's different to how the perception of the care sector in the 80s was, that it was very sort of authoritarian and you know, semi sort of violent, and you don't want your kids ending up there and all this sort of thing. But it's not I don't see that now. And, you know, you're right about the old sort of identity sort of issues when you mentioned St. Patrick's Day. Because obviously up until, I thought I was half Irish.
Yes, up until, of course.
So I would, you know, I've got a Dublin harp tattooed on me because, and I look at that, that's like a permanent sort of reminder now. And I see that now. I think, you know, it's a bit of a, you know, sort of almost complicit in this lie that without ever, without knowing it. But yeah, it's good things are changing. Change is good, and I can see it happening. And it's good that I'm doing things like this and speaking about my experiences and sharing them, because I'm hoping that sort of I could be the sort of adult I needed at 13 or whatever. I could just, you know, give a bit of perspective on maybe what. So I felt like I didn't fit in at that age, as I'm sure all teenagers do, adopted or not.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just like, you just got to talk to your kids. And you've got to go, and, you know, some things, it might be hard to talk about, but you've sort of got to go to the edge with them. You can't pull them back from it, because you try and pull them back, and that'll make them more determined to go. You just got to go there with them, and then they'll come back themselves.
There's a lot of truth in that. I'm just conscious I've asked you probably more than I meant to ask you about this, and I don't want Claire sending me DMs going, "Oh, do you think finding out that you were adopted answered questions for you?
In almost immediately.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, almost immediately, because at first I didn't know what it was, because I had no idea.
Yeah.
And although it said adoption order, whatever, granted that, you know, you had all the detail on it. I was, my wife is my wife now. She was, at the time, she was staying over with me. We weren't married then. But I said, you know, I found something. I think that's what it is. Can you have a look at it?
Yeah.
And she went, yeah, it's definitely what it is. And almost it's like she'd confirmed that that's what it is. I was like, well, all those things make sense now.
Oh, wow. Really? Okay.
Yeah, it's like all these feelings I had of why I, because me and my family, I grew up, we were really different. Loads of really sort of innocent sort of ways. Like, I liked football. They didn't like football.
Yeah.
They liked watching soaps. I didn't. It's all these sort of things. It was different sorts of sense of humour. It's like we couldn't make each other laugh. It was very little common ground. When they were saying, oh, do you want to come and do this with us at the weekend? Oh, no, thank you. I'd rather stay home. If that's the choice, I'll stay home. And we'd get all these little petty little battles going that, like, they'd dish me up a dinner. I'd say, no, I don't really, can't eat that. Don't really. I'd say, well, it's nothing else.
Bacon.
Honestly, it was boiled bacon, mashed potato and yellow cabbage was one of the regulars.
Yeah, that is an Irish dish for
sure.
And I
was like, oh, I can't. I got to an age where I felt like I could say, I can't do this, I'm sorry. And I'd say, there's nothing else there. And I'd say, fine, I won't have anything else. I'm not, I can't do that. And then they're trying and sort of, I saw it then as a game. Because then they'll try and go, oh, why don't you just have this thing then? I said, no, you said there's nothing else now, so I won't have anything. So then I'd purposely not have anything until breakfast the next morning. So you can't suck me in like that. It's not going to happen. But all these little things like that, and they always say, like, you couldn't have your door shut because you can't have secrets in the house. And all these little things, you say, can't have your door shut, your bedroom door. I was like, I'm 13 here. Can I have my bedroom door shut for what? No, you can't have your... So that was like another little thing we'd sort of argue over and all petty. And, you know, and my adopted mum left, she was a bit of a drinker.
Right.
Proper drinker. Like I'd get home from school, I'd never know what state she'd be in.
Oh, that
sort of drinking. And then she'd even almost plan it, because what she'd do is, and I could tell she'd do this, she'd do dinner at lunchtime. So when I got home from school, she'd go, oh, are you ready for dinner? About 4 o'clock. Oh, yeah, that's fine. I'll have dinner. She'd ping in the microwave because she'd be too far gone to have made it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? And it was all this sort of thing. And I was like, and I'd gone through things of like feeling like almost that addictions were hereditary.
Yeah.
And I was sort of in my 20s, early 20s, I used to drink a lot. Like I was either at work or I was out. I used to drink an awful lot. And I used to almost justify it, going, well, it's in the genes, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Of course it's not. I know that now. Yeah. But it's all these sort of identity things and all that, that sort of like as soon as I found that bit of paper and we confirmed what it was,
yeah,
I was like, well, that all makes sense now. That all makes sense why I'd feel different and why I'd like watching Football Italia on a Sunday afternoon and everyone else hated it.
Yeah.
And why I hated doing what they're doing and they'd force me into it and I'd hate every second of it. And then why they thought I'd just get a job on the industrial estate in town when I didn't really sort of want to do that, but that was the sort of class expectations that were forced onto me, and I did end up doing that even though I didn't want to. Because you know the view was, what's your education for? What do you need that for? Do you want to be a teacher? Do you want to go to university and be a teacher? If the answer is no, you don't need to go. So the factories are up there, off you go. My career's education is my daddy drove me around the industrial estate and told me what everything did. That was sort of what, whereas, and then as I got to know my birth mum, it was like, she'd, amazing woman, how she'd like, what she's done in her life amazes me. She went to university later in life as a mature student. She did an access course and went to university. She was she's like this educated sort of working class woman who sort of they viewed education as a way to push your boundaries and break free from that, and you didn't have to go in the factory if you wanted to do English or whatever.
Yeah.
It was like you could do what you want as long as you but you've got to work at it. But if you can do it, do it. And that was sort of her sort of mindset. And she went to done an access course, went to university as an adult, and like that's amazing. I tried to go back to university. I got accepted onto an access course, and then couldn't afford to do it because I couldn't work part time and do the course because they didn't do an evening one. And I tried to get back into education, but I just couldn't.
Yeah.
And we chose to support the same football team. And like all these little similarities, I was like, like I sort of talked to her about, I watched a documentary a few weeks ago about Harold Pinter, and I thought, she goes to the Globe and all that and watches outdoor theatre performances up and near where she lives and stuff. So she's into all that. So I thought, oh, you know what, that could be a way of, so I asked her if she'd watched it or if she liked him. And she texted me back and said, yeah, I do quite like him. I did that at university when I went there, but, it turns out, funny fact for you, I used to work for Arnold Wesker. I thought, oh, I know that name. Googled him because, and then it was like Sir Arnold Wesker, the famous British playwright she used to work for. And I was just I felt like, you know, if I'd have known this, if we had had like, say, like letterbox contact, for instance, as a teenager. I could have been going, oh, no, I don't have to. Yeah. Go to the meat factory. I can do this because I like this. This is good, you know. And all these little things are just like clicking into place and making sense about me because I'm getting to know her, and that's still ongoing. That's still an ongoing thing. Obviously, lockdown's seriously interrupted that because we can't see each other.
Of course.
Other in person, and you know we keep planning to, but you can't, and all this, and but I actually sat on a group thing about like a digital contact app. I think you had the lady on your podcast.
Yes, we did a couple of weeks ago.
I sat on a group a little while ago with developers, and I thought, well, this is a brilliant idea because it can really keep up momentum, and that's really hard when you're getting to know somebody, like when you're in the union, it's a birth or another member of your birth family. It's hard to slot into each other's lives, especially when you're adults, because you've got your own lives and your own things going on. But I thought, if that barrier can break down a little bit, then brilliant.
Contact is a whole other thing that we are constantly talking about on here, because it's, you know, it's a lot more restrictive than it should be. I'm just reflecting on what you said, and you've really kind of flipped this whole, your whole experience in terms of how I see adoption through the eyes of who I've spoken to, if that makes sense. So, you know, we've got, there's so many voices, but your story is quite unique in for me anyway. I'm not sure about anybody that's watching or listening. But there's a difference, because some of the stuff you've said, like my boys, my older two like football and my younger one likes rugby, and I don't like any sport, nor does my husband. So for them to kind of have that in their thing, but they know why we wouldn't be interested, whereas you didn't. So there's a kind of, you know what I mean? I'm kind of going, well,
I just thought that I was weird.
Yeah.
And I thought they thought I was weird.
Yeah.
Because I was not like them. And then when we do things like, say at school, when you do woodwork, like my, they were like tinkerers, like doing things with their hands, manual stuff. Mm. I didn't like that. I like drawing and writing and playing sport. That's what I like doing.
Yeah.
They like doing that. So I thought, oh, maybe if I do woodwork at school and I'm all right at it, that will make me feel a bit more like them, because this is obviously where I come from. I should be good at this sort of stuff, because this is my... And when I wasn't, I felt like a complete failure.
Yeah.
It's like, because I almost felt like it was, I had this sort of class thing, and I still sort of do have, maybe it's hang up, you know, got imposter syndrome everywhere you go.
Yeah,
I work in finance now. I can't get my head around that. I work in finance at a laptop. I can't believe it.
Yeah.
I go to work every day mixing with people who've got PhDs and stuff like that. On the weekend, I was on the telly talking to people with PhDs and stuff. Mm. I can't believe I'm mixing with these sorts of people. It astounds me that I do this.
Yeah.
But it's amazing at the same time. But I'm just like, I feel like I'm going to get found out at any second. Like someone's going to go, you know, you shouldn't be here, mate.
Yeah,
like what you're doing. And almost like nearly every day when I finish work and I haven't been told off, I feel like, oh, I've got away with it again. This is amazing. Like, I can't believe I'm, you know, I've just moved to this house and I've got a driveway and I'm working in finance. Like, I'm getting away with it. Mm. It's like, that sort of whole sort of clash of like me and my environment, it was like a battle all the time. And when I felt like I couldn't do things that maybe I should be, or I was getting pushed and pulled in all these different directions, it was like, I don't know what's right and what's wrong. And they think I'm weird, but I think I'm the normal one. I think they're weird. And it's all this. I was like, I didn't get it. And there was a big issue that came with like showing like affection, because I got to an age, probably a bit younger than your youngest. So I got to maybe 11, 12. And my adopted mom she loved affection. She wanted to cuddle and all this sort of stuff, all like quite a lot. And I started feeling really uncomfortable with it. And at the time, I couldn't explain why. It just made me feel uncomfortable. It didn't feel right to me that I'm doing that with these people. And she wanted to hug and say, oh, she'd be like, why can't you tell us you love us? And I was like, I don't know, I just can't. It just didn't feel, I just didn't feel like I could. And obviously I couldn't explain that at the time. It was really hard for me to get my head around it, why I couldn't hug these people. I felt like when they'd sort of put their arms around me, I'd feel a bit, you know.
Yeah.
And one of the things my adopted mum used to say to me, and this is horrendous, and I understand, it was like, it's almost like emotional abuse. She used to say, if you can't hug us and tell us you love us, you must be autistic or something. It must be something like wrong with you that you can't do that. And I was just like, oh, well, maybe I am. I don't know. At that age, see, I know.
Yeah,
I've got a bit of a feeling now why I struggled to do that at that sort of age. But it was just like I can't put myself in a place where I could do that to someone else,
yeah,
yet let alone someone who you're meant to love as your child. You know, you've presented me as your child to the world, to your own family.
Yeah.
Even, you know, you've even lied to them, your brothers and sisters. You presented me as your child to them, and you're forcing me to comply with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, behind closed doors, you're doing this to me.
Hmm.
It's just like, you know, I can't. Yeah, I sort of struggle with it. Why you sort of do that to someone?
Yeah.
The only way I can reconcile that is because I know a little bit about their pasts.
Hmm.
It's like obviously projecting their past traumas and their things that had gone unaddressed in their life previous to me onto me.
Hmm.
Because, you know, I couldn't, they obviously couldn't feel they come from that generation where you don't share and you don't admit like you're struggling and you keep it in and you just deal with it. And so they was obviously using me to try and fix themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I could, you know, nothing could have fixed them. Nothing could deal with the trauma of my adopted mum being like having like a sexual attack and I'm being unable to have further biological children as a result. But she used that to do what she did to justify her actions. But, and you know, it's just like, it's such a history of trauma and sexual violence and all this sort of stuff going on. And they're, you know, and I've just borne the brunt of it, all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's hard, isn't it? I don't want to just move on into the lockdown stuff because what you're saying obviously needs some attention because you are kind of on the other side of what should be a safe space and a safe place. And in actual fact, if you're experiencing that, that's, well, number one, it's not right. But number two, some of these things, you know, like as an example now, you know, I'm not talking like for your parent or your adoptive parents, obviously, but I'm talking about like the people that I know who obviously we don't know what goes on behind closed doors. But, you know, these days, if you've adopted a child and they can't say they love you, they can't hug you, they can't, you know, they don't want to call you mum and dad, then it's kind of part of the part and parcel of what you take on when you adopt, you know. And I know, you know, like it's a different time, but even, you know, 35 years ago when you were born and then, you know, placed for adoption, there was some knowledge of all that sort of stuff then, you know, we're not, you know, well, it's not 60 years ago you were adopted.
No, I think maybe because I didn't go through the system in a conventional way.
Right. Okay.
See, I wasn't placed with.
Sorry, I don't mean for you to oversharing this stuff.
Yeah, no, it's just that I wasn't sort of placed with social services and then they found people for me. They didn't go through any kind of process. My birth mum and those people and my adoptive parents were introduced. So I was sort of, I ended up going between birth mum to adoptive parents. And then social services becoming aware of it later. And then other things sort of happened. And then social services were then doing observations on me coming to the house, observing me with them.
Yeah.
And from the reports, just sort of decided that, oh, well, you know, rather than move this young 2-year-old, he's already had the initial relinquishment. If we move him again, he's going to have another one. But obviously they didn't really, because of how my adopted parents were presenting themselves in this situation, social services didn't realise who they were leaving me with.
Yeah.
I believe that at the time because I believe that if they had fully have been aware of everything, I wouldn't have been left with them. But anyway, it all went through and it got signed off the court. And when that happens, it's books closed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no follow up.
Yeah.
And there's no aftercare or after support unless, you know, through charities and whatnot, adopted parents can contact charities and things for support if they're sort of struggling with, you know, that didn't happen in my case.
Yeah.
It's, and then, you know, I was left with all that.
I mean, part of me wants to, like, punch somebody on your behalf. I'm not a violent person, but
no,
to
don't
put,
get me wrong.
I'm
angry about it.
Yeah, I bet you are.
And I can't confront them now.
Yes,
because they chose not to tell me that all three of them.
Yeah.
Have all died. All three of them, my adopted brother, my adopted parents.
Okay.
They all died within 3 years of each other.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And as timing goes, I had the obviously plenty of opportunity to tell me the truth.
Yeah.
They didn't. Instead, they chose to lie.
Right.
And I see it. It's case closed. I can't, you know, there's no way I can reconcile that with them.
Yeah.
Because of what they've done.
There's layers and layers upon trauma.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. When I contacted
you, we could go on for hours,
I think we're going to have to talk once we finish this and see how we can do something once Claire's podcast comes out. Because Claire's going to, if she does listen to this, she's going to think, what's he on about? Right, I've got so many questions, but I'm going to, not because I'm disrespecting you or your birth mom or even your adoptive parents, although part of me does want to
disrespect.
Can we move on a little bit?
Absolutely.
We're still chatting adoption and stuff, obviously, but your story happened a couple of years ago, but that continues on for you, and you know, I'm so privileged that you've shared it. Thank you, because I knew none of this before we started speaking, so thank you.
I'm lucky to be where I am now. I feel that, and I'm in a good place. So good. Despite all that, you know, and I love doing things like this.
Good.
Because again, it's me taking power over it.
Yeah, and, exactly. You own it, don't you? Yeah.
That's
exactly. Yeah. So lockdown seems quite insignificant.
A little bit. Seems a bit minor now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, does it? But just for the let's just carry on and see where we go. In terms of lockdown today, this year, yesterday this year or today this year, everything just kind of ground to an immediate halt with a little bit of warning, or you know, we kind of guessed it was coming, etc., etc. I always say that because I can never remember when the UK locked down, because in Ireland we locked down 2 weeks before, and I remember the pubs shut 2 days before St. Patrick's Day. So I'm kind of going when the pubs shut, which is probably not the right thing to do, but you know. So can you remember that time? Was it something that sticks in your head about what happened?
I remember being in the office actually at work, and my boss and another colleague had gone skiing in France.
Mm.
And I think they got probably one of the last flights back from France before it sort of hit. They got in a day or two before.
Yeah.
And then we have these things at work. We have an all hands every week. It's like everyone stops what they're doing and listens to this, and someone will present or whatever. There was a Q&A, and we all got called into this room, and it was just like, there's a possibility you'll all be sort of working from home and whatnot. And initially I thought, brilliant, I'm not driving to work every day. I thought, awesome, love that.
Yeah.
And I haven't got the four-way motorway roundabout on the way home that can take any time between 2 minutes and 20. I thought, happy days, I'll be able to have dinner at home with the kids every night. So that's good, love that. Yeah, saving petrol money.
Yeah.
A few weeks of that, love it. And obviously,
a few weeks. Yeah,
it's not quite been like that. And initially, I thought, this means that when we get asked to do stuff that you don't really want to do, you don't have to do it, and feeling like you don't want to do it, you're going, can't do that.
Yeah.
But it does. Yeah, March last year, because I'd only been at work there about 5 months.
Right. Okay.
I was quite new. I changed job, and so I'd sort of got to grips with everything. And it was like, all of a sudden, you're going home. It's going to be working from home. I'd never worked from home before.
Yeah.
Really. I've had to learn how to work from home. Because
it's not easy, is it?
It's not. And you think, it'd be great. But yes, it's a difficult thing to navigate because all your lines get blurred. Because normally you do your work at work and your home's at home, and it's very definite. and all these lines are blurring, and it's difficult to find your boundaries. And you know, and we haven't got a room where you can set up a laptop, you can have an office and close the door on it. We haven't got that. And my wife's working from home as well. And then it's just like, how are we going to negotiate this? And we're just sort of almost getting to grips with it now. But we've had some big life things happen during the past year. I mean, my oldest lad started school in September.
Yeah, of course.
So the first part of lockdown, it was like, your kids are going to be home, but we weren't homeschooling. We were just sort of looking after them.
Yeah.
Well, not really looking after them, just letting them look after themselves.
Giving them an iPad.
And it's just, you know, learn how to work the TV fairly quick.
And, Life skills.
Yeah, see it. And they've done all the puzzles and things.
Yeah.
And in a way, it was great for the boys because they'd spent a lot more time together than what they normally would have spent.
Right.
Because they would have been at whatever childcare setting they were at.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they've spent that time together and they've grown really close, which is a beautiful thing to watch when you see them. Not so much when they're wrestling each other off the sofa, but, you know, you do see them little glimpses of how much they care about each other. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've had that time and you see that.
So when you're talking about work then, because you mentioned earlier about imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
So working from home, not being in contact with people, I'm not putting words in your mouth here, but this I guess how I feel, because I've suffered from imposter syndrome and I do quite frequently actually. What was it when you're working from home initially, were you panicked about the work that you're producing, not being able to speak to colleagues, your boss, you know, all that sort of stuff, as in face-to-face? Was that a panic for you?
It was, because I've got a thing, I don't like phoning people, I don't like talking on the phone. I'm all right like this because I can see you.
Yeah, got a bit of comment because I hate speaking on the phone.
And I'm all right writing stuff to other people.
Yeah.
But it was just like, you know, it was like every time you'd want to talk to you, I was like, what have I done wrong?
Yeah.
Most of the time I hadn't, but that's what my brain jumps to.
Yeah.
Every sort of all the time. And he's like, oh, you want to keep in contact with me because you think I'm not doing it right, all this.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was, I must admit as well, during autumn, so about September time, it's funny enough, it was when we put the house up for sale.
Right.
And we started having viewings.
Mm.
I had a massive downturn.
Right.
Sort of mental health sort of downturn.
Yeah.
Sort of, you could feel it creep, but then over a few weeks, then all of a sudden it went really quickly, really fast.
Mm.
And what, I don't know if it was a bit of a thunderbolt that I realised I might be unwell. Because I watched this this guy give a talk on YouTube. He worked in an addiction center, and he's talking about neurochemistry and stuff, and how early trauma can wire up your neuro pathways and set what your default, almost what your default behaviors are going to be for the rest of your life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, this guy is just, this is how I behave. He's not everything. And at that point, I thought, I might not be well.
Hmm.
I just thought that's normal for me,
right.
But maybe it doesn't have to be.
Right.
Yeah. I thought all these things, that's just what I do all the time. Like, I don't like opening mail, hate it.
Yeah.
Don't like answering the phone, don't like it. Don't like meeting new people. Makes me feel strange, a very small cloak, and all these sort of things, and about how your brain jumps to almost the worst possible scenario happening. Even though it's not, it's just a normal everyday thing that most people do. I might not be well, but maybe my normal behaviour is me being not well, but maybe because he's talking about it and these things have got names,
maybe
I don't have to be unwell. And that was like a massive, like, that just hit me like a thunderclap. And I said to my wife, I said, you need to watch this YouTube talk with me. Do you remember what was that? Because I don't normally do that sort of thing. Why do I have to watch that with you? So I just might help you understand, you know, talks about, you know, early childhood relinquishments and traumas and things. I think it just might help you understand how I behave sometimes. And she went, are you all right? And I went, yeah. And then she went, are you sure? And it was the, are you sure? And I went, actually, I don't think I am. And I just went. I was sobbing, and I was all over the place.
Yeah.
And obviously, after that, I felt better. I thought, well, actually, I've recognised something that I can not fix, but I can address.
Yeah.
And then, but then I had to, like, the next day, I felt like I had to tell the people I worked with. And I had to sit, you know, when this is at the time when we were mixing back in between.
Right, yeah.
So I was working from home a few days and then going into the office a couple of days in Newham. And I had to sort of tell the two people that were in the office at that time. I said, look, this happened to me yesterday and you need to know about it because this is how my brain behaves. And it's normal to me, but to you guys, it might not be. You might not struggle to understand why and they were brilliant about it. And I had to have a video call like this with my boss a little bit after, but he was good with it. But after that, I've just gone up.
Right.
It's really bizarre. It's like I was sort of, you get these sort of, oh, I could do this and that, and you end up buzzing off all these ideas. And that's a similar time. It was just after that I started getting brought into these sort of groups by a lady called Dee who works at, she sort of brought me into these sorts of things. I've done things with Claire and I was like, oh, you know what? I'm owning this now. I'm talking about and I'm sort of regaining myself and I'm getting to learn. And it's since that happened, that was me sort of bottoming out, I think. That was like the base of the trough and now I'm coming up the peak. And you know, we shed that, got rid of that house now. We're in a new place.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of I've cut them last couple of things that would tie me back to the old me. And it is an old me. It's really bizarre. I do consider the old me a different person. It's almost like, you know, a clone or man in the iron mask sort of thing. Where you're like, it's a different, you know, things you learn, like I'm not even walking around with the name I was given.
Right.
So I've got the name my adopted parents gave me, but it's also what I've given to my wife and my children.
Yeah.
So I've got to walk around with that, but everything else, I'm sort of, you know, it's a process, and it doesn't end. It just it's continuous, you know, just sort of look at it as kind of a scale. Like, and sometimes you're at one and sometimes you're at, and you just sort of coast along and you negotiate things. And so lockdown's been, obviously, my lad starting school is a big thing.
Yeah. Do you think that maybe had a bit of an impact on that? I mean, you know, on the way you were, your mental health at that point.
Yeah, maybe it was because that's obviously a relinquishment as well of sorts. That, it's like me not being able to keep him with me.
Yeah.
So I felt a very sort of thing that I had a responsibility to make sure I was bonding with my children and I'd take an active role in bonding with my children. I tried really, really hard. Part of me thought it's more natural that happens with the mum because of biology and whatnot and the own experiences. I thought as a dad, I've really got to try hard to, so I've got an equal bond that they have between both of us.
Yeah.
And then, then he sort of hits sort of five and goes off to school. And he's like, you know, he's sort of flaming a nest. But it's just like he's hit that sort of stage in his, he just sort of hit that stage in his life. And I remember in a way starting school, and it was horrendous. School for me was horrible as a young And I hope he likes it.
Mm.
You know, I don't want him to feel like he's suffering by being away from us.
Yeah.
But luckily, from his nursery, we got him, he was on the waiting list, but we got him into the school where a lot of the kids from the nursery had followed through to. So he'd got to go to school in the end with people that he knew, and you thought, oh, that's great. He's going to have people he knows at school, other children who he knows, who have got parents that we know, and that was so comforting for us. And but yeah, I think maybe it did, because all these things were on my mind all the time. When the kids hit these sort of developmental stages, I think back to me at those times, if I can remember it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no psychologist, and you know, but often our own experiences can contribute to how we kind of react to stuff like this, can't it? Doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember when going into the school for the first time, when we were about to have our older two boys placed with us into a primary school. And I remember just the smell, and it's the smell of the school in its own way. I've never been into a school since I left school, and just the smell hit me, and it took me back so many years. And I just had complete triggers about bullying and all that sort of stuff. You know, if you've experienced that, it's really difficult to kind of deal with those kinds of things.
I can imagine, because smells are funny, aren't they?
Yeah.
Because sometimes I see old photographs. So, like, old photographs, what the front room was used to look like, and I can smell it.
Yeah.
And it just, like, and you're there.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre how these little things can sort of put you in a certain place.
Really affects you, isn't it?
Yeah. And your lad's teachers, they know, obviously, because, you know, they're adopted and whatnot. So they're sort of aware of that. But the thing I can't help thinking is, did my school know?
Yeah.
Would they have known? Do you know what I mean? It's like, would they have known? Yeah. Because I've got a feeling that maybe people, the list of people who knew and I didn't know, sort of grows. And I just always think, I'm back and said, oh, would my teacher have a note on my file at school somewhere that said that, or whatever, you know. Just part of me thinks I want to track some of my old teachers down and ask them straight out.
Yeah.
And even like every time I've been to the doctors or seen a doctor, would they have known? Is that a little note somewhere they can read? They know and I don't, and all this.
That's really interesting. That is a really interesting thing, because I think that some of that, from my perspective anyway, I'm not talking about from your side, but some of that I would see as a little bit paranoia, if that makes sense. Not because you're being paranoid, just because, so as an example with teachers, you know what, trying to get sometimes, no disrespect to any teachers that are listening, by the way, but it's just sometimes really difficult to get into a teacher that you want to share why there may be certain behaviours, why they've got their OCD, what their experiences have been. So it's very difficult to do that. And I think with the doctor thing as well, you know, the NHS number is a massive bit of controversy around that, because obviously your NHS number changes, you know, when you're legally adopted and all that sort of stuff. And it's just like, did you not? Yeah. We'll talk more about that afterwards. But obviously your case was a little bit different, but equally you still got an adoption certificate. So that would have, maybe back then, I don't know, because obviously it's, you know, things change over time and all that sort of stuff. But all that stuff is just so, you know, to kind of take out what is adoption and what is not and all that sort of stuff. I mean, blimey, you must just live in your head most of the day, wondering what's normal and what's not.
Honestly, I do. Because sometimes, like, I have to sort of work plugged in all the time.
Yeah.
Like, I'll have a podcast on, or I'll have music on. And sometimes I can get really zoned into what I'm doing and almost zen out. And I can be there for a little while, just getting on. But it doesn't take a lot. Mm. And I'm pulled out of that.
Right.
And I'm pulled out of it. I could be pulled out of it for an hour. Just like I used to do this thing. I noticed it in the old house. Especially when there was days when my wife's in the office and the boys were at school. And my other lad was in nursery. So I was working at home on my own. And I'd just find myself doing laps to the house. I could go walk around the front room, then walk around the dining room table, up the stairs, into the bathroom, look out the window, in each bedroom, look out the window. Just do laps around. Mm. I could do that for like 20 minutes. Yeah. Thinking about some thoughts just got me and it's pulled me in and I've just rumbled on with it. Because what normally happens is I'll have an idea and then within, it doesn't take many leaps. Say like, for instance, I'll go, oh, my story might be quite interesting. So I'll write a book. And then what will happen is I'll do that and then I'll send it to someone and they'll like it. And then what will happen is it will be published. And what will happen is I'll get like some recognition and then I'll make some money. And then I won't, I'll be able to quit work. So that'll be fine. And then what will happen then is I'll get well known and then I'll write more. And then I'll end up winning like the Booker Prize and selling the film rights and all this. And that's happened all within about 10 seconds.
Right.
Then I'm off running around the house thinking, when am I going to find the time to write this book then? Because I've got this job that I've got to, I've got the kids, you know, I know this writer who stays up late and does it. Maybe I could, maybe when my wife goes to bed at 10, I could stay up till like 2. Yeah. And if I write X thousand words, that'll take, and it's just like, that go, that just, this all just sort of spins out. I could be, that's what it happens all the time. It's really bizarre.
Yeah.
But so it's, everything's really, really internal.
Yeah,
and because of all the timing of this sort of stuff, because I found out my adopted mum died 6 weeks before my eldest son was born.
Right.
So, and then, so just after me and my wife got married, we fell off the social scene because when you're pregnant, our social scene was very revolved around the pub and drinking and going out.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My friends did that all the time, and I was a nightmare drinker. I was horrendous. If I had more than one, it would be 10. I was a nightmare. Okay.
Yeah.
And so I had to pull back from that. And my wife was unwell. So I thought, oh, I'm going to be supportive here. I'm going to pull back from that and support her through this. So we fell off the sort of social scene. So then all the reunion, sort of finding out the real story and all the reunion stuff has happened since then. And I haven't just realised, I haven't hardly been in touch with my mates in 5 years.
Right.
Just because we fell out of that group and we haven't managed to get back in, and now some of them are married and had their own. There might be a sort of a little bit of a way
back in there,
but you know, some of my good mates, I've had a mate who's died and all sorts, and they don't know this about me, so I can't. And you can't, during this sort of lockdown thing, you can't sort of do it like this. Well, you can, because we have. But, you know, someone who I almost saw every weekend and we were really close, it's like, how can I have this? And I'll tell you what, I had a mate. And, like, adoption is not a joke. Like, I'm at that place where I don't find adoption jokes funny. They're offensive. Yeah. It's almost like, you know, we're like a marginalised group. And I see it akin to that, and he was like, you know, you wouldn't make racist jokes, you shouldn't do jokes about adoption, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But he used to joke when he was about 21, 22, he used to joke, said, you must be adopted because you're quite, I'm not that tall, I'm average height, but he said, your parents are only about that big, you're much bigger than them, so you must be, and all this sort of stuff. And he used to joke about it. After I said, oh, leave it out, mate, it's not funny.
Yeah.
And fast forward sort of 10 years, and I was like, he was right. Oh, he was right all along, even though it was a joke, he was right. And I was like, but I haven't told him he was right, because how can I can't bring him up and go,
do that as well. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, you know.
And I'm sure he would feel rotten if he thought that he said that as a joke.
Because I had to break a little family secret to him. I'd say, right, okay, now I've said that, right, a little bit. I know my adoptive mum back in the past used to look after another little girl who was someone else's. I'm not exactly sure whose, but again, it was a similar thing where she looked after her, and it was sort of, so I thought, she got form. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, she got a rap sheet. Mm. And I was like, you can't joke about this because I know that happened in the past. So it's not funny. And to be fair to him, from then on, he stopped.
Yeah.
But he was like, he was right all along. I was like, I just listened to him and asked her straight out.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, it's bizarre, isn't it?
What an absolute, well, I don't know how to describe the hour that I've spent with you now. I'm intrigued more than anything else, and
I don't think we touched lockdown and all.
No, I don't think we did. I was going to say something before before we finish, though, I would like to ask you, because obviously you have been affected by it from what you've said, in one way or another, whether that's been an ongoing thing, whether it was just one, you know, blip in September, whether that was the fact that your blip was then a realization of this is who I am, how I am, this is how I can bring myself out of it. So have you got any like reflections on lockdown as an adopted adult, albeit late to the party adopted adult, if that's a thing? I don't know if that's the right way to word it or not, but yeah. You know what I'm saying. Have you got any kind of any reflections on it at all in terms of how you've dealt with it, and you know, just one thing that you've, one tip you've got, one hint, I don't know. To parents and adopted adult or adopted people alike.
I don't think it's just specific to adopted people, but like being in reunion's been difficult during lockdown. So reach out to people. If you want to keep in touch with them, reach out to them, because once you lose that momentum, it's hard to regain it.
Yeah,
I think, and it's hard to slot into other people's lives. And yeah, don't let it slide. You don't have to. The technology's out there.
Yeah,
you know, true. You don't have to. And routines are really important.
Yeah,
like don't work in your work area in the same clothes you slept in. Don't do that. It's not a good road to start down. Don't do that.
I've only just stopped in that the last 2 days.
Yeah, if you go down that road, I found getting dressed to be, you know, good for your productivity.
Yeah. Okay, I'm saying no more about that. Listen, before I let you go, and I think we've got loads more to speak about, and if you're happy to, I know that when people listen to this, they're going to say, okay, when are you having him back on? Because they're just going to be interested in what you've got to say on various things, plus your story. And it's not that people are, well, maybe some are, like, looking at stories and going, oh, that's just a really juicy story. I'd like to know more about that. But I think, you know, a genuine kind of adoptive parents of this generation are more interested in the effects and the causes and all that sort of stuff. But I just wanted to mention Dee, because you mentioned Dee there, and Dee is like a bit of a whirlwind in the adoption community.
Amazing woman.
She doesn't take enough credit. We've asked her on so many times, and she keeps, like, she's not blocked us, but she keeps on ignoring the question. And I said one day, I said, I'm just going to send you a calendar invite and see if you turn up for an interview. So I'm maybe just try that, actually. But Dee seems to, I mean, I've worked with Dee because I worked with Adoption UK when she worked at PAC UK. And the work that she was doing back then, even 4 or 5 years ago, you know, just bringing voices forward, whether it was birth parents or adopted adults, it didn't matter, you know.
It's amazing what she's done and is doing. I'm so glad that she sort of pulled me out of social media and said, you know, what you have to say will be relevant to people who are in the adoption triad now. And if what I'm saying, if a parent of an, I don't know what the right term is, an adopted parent, is that the right term? Adopted parent is listening to this and are unsure of how to address things with their children, I'm here, ask me. Because it's important that things are addressed with your children, because if it doesn't happen, it can be very destructive. The effects it can have on their lives, to either gloss over or avoid completely, or, you know, everyone's tempted to, I don't know, just make it easier for themselves at the time. I think you've got to do the hard work.
Yeah.
And it is hard work, and there's no getting around it. And, you know, it might not be. Everyone's adoption experiences are different. And we sort of mentioned before how sort of binary opinions and responses and one-size-fits-all approaches can be unhelpful. Look at me. And if me coming on and doing things like this, I think it can help people. I think it can help adopted parents. I think it can help adopted children or children foster care or whatever kind of care experience they've got. I've suffered. They don't have to.
I think that's really good advice. And I didn't stop you there. You just stopped automatically, which is the first time in an hour and 5 minutes. So well done.
Thanks. Yeah. No, like I said to you, I can go and you've got to reel me in.
See, if it was Al here, he'd be stopping you and asking you questions. That's another story. We'll talk about that another day. Well, listen, Daniel, thank you so much for joining. Really appreciate it. Can I just say one thing? If you were to write a book, I think that it would probably be a very popular book in this. Whether you'd make any money and be able to give up work, I don't know if that would be a thing.
On book number two.
Yeah, exactly. But in all seriousness, I think that story is dare I say it, and I'm trying to be respectful to all of your family there. That kind of story is how things perhaps shouldn't be done in terms of adoption, and I think there's quite a clear message in there, really, isn't there?
Absolutely, it is. Yeah, don't do it like this. This is what happens.
Yeah,
but it's what it is. Well, it's not what it is. It's wrong. But if we again, I'll say if we can highlight this, and it doesn't have to happen again to anyone. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to be like this.
Yeah, exactly. And we've just had our first comment of the evening and our very last, because we're going to end in a minute. Respect to you. With three kisses from EWB Jones.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me. It's been great.
No, thank you. Really appreciate it.
If we can do it again at another time,
We're going to chat when I click this button here. Thank you, Daniel. And take care, everyone. Next week, I'm back with Shona White, who is at Singing Haggis on Twitter. Shona, I was going to say born and brought up with. I wasn't born with. I was brought up with her. I've known her since I was four, and she's adopted. We went to high school together, etc. So it's going to be a conversation about how her lockdown has been, especially given that the arts are all closed down at the minute. So join me for that next Wednesday at 8 o'clock.